The final panelist of the afternoon was Stuart Warko, Executive Vice President of ICM Artists and Director of its Conductors Division. Mr. Warko was house manager of Carnegie Hall for many years, and his association with Maestro Stokowski began early on when he was an assistant for the conductor's New York appearances and recording sessions with the New York City Opera and the Metropolitan Opera between 1962 and 1968. Mr. Warko, along with Leopold Stokowski, played a major role in the establishment of the American Symphony Orchestra. Mr. Stuart Warko.
Well, as the junior member of this panel, I'm really very proud to be in such distinguished company, such legendary company indeed. My first meeting with Stokowski was in the mid-50s when I was a very young man in my early 20s. And I had started to work with the Symphony of the Air, which was the former NBC Symphony, when Toscanini retired and NBC unceremoniously dumped the orchestra. The musicians decided to try to make a go of it on their own as a cooperative. And I just happened to be at the right place at the right time, not knowing anything about orchestra management. I said, yes, I didn't know the meaning of the word no can do. And I started as a volunteer and ultimately ended up working for them. There was a possibility that Stokowski was going to be doing some concerts with the orchestra, and I was dispatched to take some papers up to his apartment, and this was going to be my first meeting with him, and I believe it was in 1955. So I said, oh, this record just came out on RCA Vault Treasures that had just been re-released of Schoenberg's Gurlieder. So I said, okay, I'll take it with me, and I'll have Stokowski sign it. So I went up to the apartment. He answered the door himself in a bathrobe and was very courteous, very cordially asked me my name, a little bit about my background, escorted me in, went through the papers that he had to look at, and then I took out the record and I said, Maestro, would it be an imposition? Would you autograph this for me? He looked at it and asked me whether I enjoyed the performance, what I thought of the work, etc. And then as he opened the album, this was in days of LP, and he took it out of its inner sleeve and started to sign it on the label. And I hate to tell you, the first thought in my head was, keep your fingers off the grooves. But I didn't say it, and I have my signed Schoenberg Gurlieder. And that started a rather interesting and diverse association with Stokowski over a period of many years. He did have one aspect to him that a lot of people may not really realize. He did have a devilish sense of humor and sometimes a little bit of a sarcastic one, too. It was in the 50s, in the course of my work with the Symphony of the Air, that an American violinist who had been a protege and a student of Heifetz, who came from a rather well-to-do background, wanted to give a concert in Newark, New Jersey. And they had the wherewithal to hire the orchestra with Stokowski, and Stokowski agreed to conduct the concert. And it was going to be the Brahms Violin Concerto, and I think the first part of the concert was the Unfinished Symphony and some other piece. Well, in the course of the rehearsals with the violinist, it turned out that he was rather young and brash and snippy, and sort of one of these young types that makes faces and thinks he knows everything and turns around and wants to say things, you know, to the orchestra and the conductor. Well, at a certain point in rehearsing the concerto, Stokowski stopped, and he sat back and paused for a moment, and he looked at the orchestra and in his very unique accented English said, you know, this is a wonderful, wonderful concerto. I remember the first time I heard this concerto. Then he looked at the violinist and said, oh yes, I remember Joachim. And that was his very subtle way of saying, don't tell me how it goes, Buster. Also, one of the other unique gifts of Stokowski was his ability to be a Pied Piper and a magician in the true sense. You know that from Fantasia, when Mickey Mouse comes up and says, shakes hands, which his kids always loved, and he rather got a kick out of it himself. He did children's concerts. And many of you here in Philadelphia certainly may remember the wonderful, wonderful young people's concerts that he gave. And that really set the pattern for a lot of orchestras around the country. People tend to think of the children's concerts that Bernstein did, but when you know and saw what Stokowski did, you couldn't hold a candle to it. But they were also touched by occasional humor. And there's a famous story that he was doing a children's concert and was talking about animals and explaining things to the children and was asking the kids questions and hoping that somebody would respond. And he said, "Who here knows what is a giraffe?" Silence. He looked at the kids again. He said, "Surely someone can tell me here what is a giraffe." Dead silence. Finally, one little kid down front raises his head and says, "Yes, young man, tell me please, what is a giraffe?" And so the youngster says, "Mr. Stokowski, a giraffe is a giraffe." But there's also, of course, as Bernie had touched on, the element of the pioneer and the adventurer in Stokowski. And you have to go back to 1912 when he first assumed the music directorship of the Philadelphia Orchestra and look at what that program was. This was a young man of 30 whose only prior orchestra experience had been in Cincinnati. Prior to that, he had been an organist and choral conductor, also played the violin. In addition to the Brahms First Symphony and the Beethoven Leonore Overture No. 3, first performance at these concerts, Ippolitov Ivanov Caucasian Sketches. And that, in a sense, set the pattern, because shortly after that, in 1916, the American premiere of the Mahler Eighth Symphony, people don't realize that he was the first one to do Das Lied von der Erde, that he was the first one to stage Wozzeck in this country, that he also was the first one to stage Stravinsky's Oedipus Rex with the 20-foot puppets, that there were times when he put the Philadelphia Orchestra in the pit and conducted complete ballets, and that so many pieces of contemporary repertoire that you know today, he was the first one to do. So if you ever have a chance to look through the archives of the Philadelphia Orchestra, I think you'll really be quite surprised. And this was something that he held fast to, even in his later years. When he had formed the American Symphony in 1962, and I was fortunate enough to become its manager, a few years into the life of the orchestra, we had the occasion to do the world premiere of Charles Ives' Fourth Symphony, a much expected work, something that had languished for years, and parts of it had to be put together. With the efforts of Henry Cowell, who was a good friend of Stokowski's, we managed to assemble it. It was such a complicated and fearsome work that normally you would have four orchestra rehearsals for a symphony concert. We went to the Rockefeller Foundation and got some money to do six additional rehearsals. All in all, there were 10 rehearsals for that concert. In 1965, that was really rather unheard of. It was a monumental task, and remember that the maestro was 83 at the time. And it also had to employ two assistant conductors to help put it together. Not being content with having the Ives Fourth on the program to ensure box office success, he also did the Beethoven Fifth and a Wagner Overture and the Swan of Tuonela. There's also another interesting part of Stokowski's career that I was involved in, and that was his association with the Metropolitan Opera. In 1959 or 1960, the Met was going to mount a new production of Turandot, which had not been given at the Met for many, many years. I think Cecil Beaton was the set and costume designer. Well, that was assigned to Dmitri Mitropoulos. Shortly after Mitropoulos accepted to conduct Turandot, he died while conducting a concert, I believe, in Italy. The Met then offered the production to Stokowski, and he agreed to undertake it. Well, shortly after agreeing to do so, he was at home one afternoon playing in the apartment with his young sons, and it had an enormous long hall that was very highly polished. And they were sort of horsing around, and he was playing football and kicking the ball, you know, in the hall and playing with the boys, and evidently slipped and fell and broke his hip. I was at home that afternoon, and I got a call from one of Stokowski's friends saying the maestro had had an accident, and I guess my first reaction was, is he alive? They told me rather tearfully what had happened, and I quickly got into a cab, went over to the apartment. By that time, he had pulled himself into the nearest bedroom, and you could see the pain absolutely written all over his face, and yet he was doing push-ups and trying, you know, I guess in his own mind he was trying to avoid rigor mortis or looking for the worst, but he was just trying to be active. The ambulance came, you know, took him to the hospital. He was operated on. It was a hip replacement, and I visited him several times in the hospital. I remember once when I came, I was told to wait at the elevator and not to go to his room. And sure enough, who do I see standing down at the end of the hall? Stokowski with his crutches. And he was going to come to me, and I didn't have to go to him. Needless to say, he recovered really quite extraordinarily for someone of his age. We did the rehearsals of the Turandot at the Met, and it was an enormous, enormous success and a great triumph for him. I assisted him at the rehearsals, and I sat in the pit with him for all the performances. He had a habit in the course of an operatic performance that he would like to call down something that may have gone wrong in the performance. So I'd sit on the steps at his feet in the pit, and while conducting Turandot, he would mumble something, and I'd have my score, and I'd write it in, make notes, give it to him so that he could correct it for the next performances. But when we came into rehearsals in the morning, I would pick him up at home, and we sort of had a bargain. In some ways, he was not the last of the big time spenders, and in some ways, he was generous. So the bargain was this. I would bring the thermos of coffee, because we both liked it the same way, to the rehearsals, and he would bring the ham sandwiches. Well, his maid, Margaret, made exactly 2 ham sandwiches every day. And this went on for about 10 days of rehearsal. And we would just dutifully, during lunch hour, go to his dressing room, and we'd have our ham sandwiches and my coffee. But very often in the mornings, we would come in and have a cup of tea with Rudolf Bing. One morning, we sit there, and Stokowski reaches into his pocket, and he takes out a little notepad on which he's written some items. We're having our tea, and of course, you know, Mr. Bing was very much of a martinet when he ran the Met. It was also around the time that they were planning Lincoln Center and the new opera house. Well, Stokey, in many ways, was a visionary, and very often he would come up with ideas that were quite often out of left field, very often ideas that were quite realistic, if impractical. But always there was a germ of something very interesting, very real, and very farsighted. So he went down a few items, and Bing poo-pooed them, and I didn't think not the nicest way, considering that he was talking to Stokowski. And then the last item on the list, Stokowski said, Mr. Bing, you are building a new opera house. I think it should have a movable proscenium so that you can do the enormous works, a large chorus of Handel, or reduce the proscenium to do the more intimate works of Mozart. And then he said something else very telling. And for works yet unwritten. Moment of silence. And then Bing started to say, well, my dear maestro, I think this and that. And his final statement was, as you know, for the next 30 years, the repertoire is going to be basically Italian opera. Silence. Stokey, almost with a kind of a childlike innocence, looked at him and said, Mr. Bing, you mean you're only building an opera house for 30 years? you know. But anyway, I won't take much more of your time, but just to let you know that I enjoyed my relationship with him. He was quite an extraordinary man. I did touch on his sense of humor. Oh, it just reminds me of one little story. We were talking about planning some programs for the American Symphony, and I had to call him from somewhere. So I got him on the phone, and I said, "Maestro, you know, you haven't done the Tchaikovsky Romeo and Juliet overture and fantasy, you know, in a while. Perhaps you might want to include that in the program." And so he said, "What piece?" And I said, "The Tchaikovsky Romeo and Juliet." He says, "I don't think I know it." And I, being quite new, says, "Oh, yes, of course, Maestro, you know it." And he says, "Oh, how does it go?" And I fell for it. And I'm standing in a telephone booth singing to Stokowski on the telephone, da-dee-da-da-da-dee-da-da, you know, only to hear him chuckling, you know, at the other end. So there was very definitely an element of humanity. There was a touch of humor. There was also the other side of him not to cross. There's the whole bit of the Bach and musical transcriptions, and he was a wonderful organist, and I had an occasion to hear him play the organ twice, and in both occasions it was the opening of the famous Toccata and Fugue in D minor, and I can assure you he played it exactly as he conducted it. It was quite extraordinary. Once having heard that, and then you hear the transcriptions and how he approached it and how he had the ear for the lower strings and how he had the unique ear for balance, it was quite extraordinary. I just want to conclude with one other remark, and we were talking about this at lunch when you were addressing the Stokowski sound, which I guess I and other people refer to as the Philadelphia sound, something quite unique that I've never really heard again since Stokowski. At one point, the London Symphony was coming over to do an American tour. They had just appointed Pierre Monteur, who was 89 years old, as the music director, and he was going to come and do this American tour. Unfortunately, Pierre Monteur died before he could do the tour, so they then engaged George Schulte to do the tour. When they came to New York, in addition to the already scheduled concert, they wanted to do a special memorial concert for Monteur, and Stokowski and Monteur were good friends. They admired each other very, very much, and Stokowski was quite saddened at the death of Monteur. But rehearsal time on tour is always very, very tight. So there was a rehearsal being scheduled one morning, and it had to be split between several participants. Schulte had a part of that rehearsal to touch up a piece he was doing on one of the tour programs. And you listen to the London Symphony and you watch Schulte, and if you know the characteristics of Schulte, that's exactly what you got. It was clipped and it was sharp and it was quite strong. The memorial concert was going to be conducted by both Stokowski and Pablo Casals. Casals came and with a smaller group rehearsed the Bach Fifth Brandenburg with Serkin on the piano and the choral Fantasy. And the orchestra already had a different color. It had a more classical line to it, and really quite different from what Schulte had done. During the intermission, Stokowski came and started to rehearse the Shostakovich Fifth Symphony. And there were a few of us sort of sitting together in the orchestra listening to the rehearsal. And about 3 or 4 minutes into the symphony, we just turned to one another and just simply said the word, Philadelphia. And this was a unique quality where he could get up literally in front of any ensemble and change the complete character of their sound. It is indeed extraordinary. Thank you.
Stuart Warko, Executive Vice President of ICM Artists and Director of its Conductors Division. This concludes the Stokowski Symposium, Music Making with the Maestro, held at the University of Pennsylvania on April 15, 1998. a celebration of the life and works of Maestro Leopold Stokowski and of the transfer of the Stokowski collection from the Curtis Institute of Music to the University of Pennsylvania Library. A permanent online exhibit features biographical information, photographs, programs, articles, and more. It also features the only known recording of Stokowski playing the organ, a previously unreleased recording that is listenable over the Internet. For an exciting online look at the Stokowski collection, visit the Stokowski collection website at http://www.library.upenn.edu/special/gallery/Stokowski.